This is KUOW's The Record. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. A couple of months ago, I had a cold, and I sounded kind of gunked up for a few days. I was really tired, and you're probably hearing me talk about my cold thinking, I don't care that you got sick, Bill, which is fair enough. For Hillary Clinton, though, this is a different story. Clinton has been in the spotlight after being diagnosed with pneumonia and then hushing it up. Well, our next guest heads a local group called Moms Rising. Kristen Rowe Finkbeiner advocates for paid family and sick leave. And she says the focus on Clinton's illness points to a much bigger problem.
One of the biggest problems in America right now is that too often things like getting sick are seen as failures. And that when people, particularly women in the labor force, get sick, you're sort of damned if you do and damned if you don't. If you tell people that you're sick, you're seen as weak. And if you don't tell people that you're sick and then they find out, you're seen as weak. But the truth of the matter is that 80% of low-wage workers and 40% of private sector workers in America don't have a single paid sick day right now. So we have a culture where suppressing the fact that you're sick or acting as if it's a personal failure that you're sick, even though everybody gets sick, is too often seen. So what we need to do is we need to say we aren't having an epidemic of personal failures. It's not a personal failure to get sick. We need structural change. We need everybody to be able to take paid sick days. There's a guaranteed minimum number of sick days in 166 countries, but not in the U.S. So it's time for us to catch up so that when everybody has a chance to stay home when they're sick, we can start also changing the culture and changing our health for the better.
Did you say, Kristen, that women work when they're sick? Doesn't everybody do that? I work sick.
Yeah, I think everybody to some extent works when they're sick. What happens with women is something in particular, and particularly with moms. Right now, being a mom in America is a greater predictor of wage and hiring discrimination than being a woman. Hillary Clinton is both. She's a woman and a mom and a grandmom. And one of the reasons why is that we don't have family economic security policies like access to sick days, like access to paid family leave after a new baby arrives, affordable child care and health care for everybody. So moms in particular as caregivers are judged more harshly in studies from Stanford and Cornell University for what happens in the labor force if they're late or if they get sick. There's tons of data showing that. So Hillary Clinton falls right within that sort of being judged more harshly zone than men and certainly even women without children. And so it is something she has to be careful of in terms of how she shares that she's sick, and it's something that she's not alone in doing.
Now, obviously, Hillary Clinton is different from an office worker. She is running for president and standing for election here in a couple of months.
Absolutely. And even so, I would argue the pressure is on her even more. Right now, I will confess that I am struggling with a really bad case of bronchitis. And I didn't want to say this on the radio. I didn't want people to think, oh, Kristen shouldn't be working. Oh, Kristen should, you know, sit down and be quiet.
That would make you a hypocrite. Why are you working with bronchitis?
Because I'm getting better. But one of the things is that people don't want to share when they're sick. They don't want to, you know, talk about being sick. You don't want to be sort of seen as wanting a lot of get well soon notes or concern. And you certainly don't want to be seen as somebody who needs to be told to go to bed and be quiet, particularly when you have very few days left in a presidential campaign. So it's both somewhat in our culture, we don't talk about being sick, and also it can be something that can sideline people. So I completely understand that if I feel uncomfortable talking about being sick, that Hillary Clinton would feel 5,000 times more uncomfortable talking about being sick, because I am certainly not running for president of the United States of America, where the judgments are much more harsh.
In the special case of Hillary Clinton, it's not just that she's sick, it's that she didn't say something earlier, and we expect a lot of transparency from our presidential candidates. Isn't that fair to that they tell us about their health?
Well, there's varying degrees of this type of illness, you know, in terms of pneumonia, whether it's serious or not. Clearly, it was somewhat serious because after getting dehydrated and then standing out in the heat in a Kevlar vest and, you know, having a day take its toll on her, she felt really sick. But pneumonia isn't always an incredible death sentence. In fact, it's rarely that. And so the question is, what do people have to disclose? Do you have to disclose that you have a cold? You know, do you have to, at what point do you need to disclose these things? I'm sure that from her perspective, she is an incredible soldier. She's an incredible tough lady. She does roll up her sleeves and gets things done. I'm sure that she didn't think it was a big deal. Just having talked with her, I'm sure she was like, pneumonia, schmonia. I'm running for president and I'm going to keep going.
You don't think we'd be talking the same way about Trump pneumonia?
Oh, I think Trump-monia.
Trump-monia.
I'm going to call it Trump-monia. I think that would be completely different. We have seen General Petraeus. He fainted when he was testifying. Nobody called for him to resign or said he had a body double or had any kind of weird conspiracy theories after he fainted. We had one of the presidents, George Bush. He actually vomited on a world leader and then passed out.
Yes.
Nobody called for his resignation. So we have an incredible different standard for female leaders than male leaders. So it's long past time to think about and what it means to get sick and what it means to get better. Because again, everybody gets sick, but not everybody has a chance to get better, and not everybody is judged the same when they get sick. So we have to be careful and check our sort of internal assumptions about what it means when people get sick. And when we look at what happens when Hillary gets sick and we remember what happened when President George Bush actually vomited on a world leader, many people laughed. And so, you know, they didn't call for his resignation. So it's quite different.
Kristin Rowe Finkbeiner is executive director of Moms Rising. She advocates for paid family and sick leave, and she would like you to look beyond the Hillary Clinton pneumonia case and think about what it means to be sick in American culture and how we deal with that in our workplaces. By the way, Rowe Finkbeiner told me that Puget Sound area businesses are ahead of the curve when it comes to paid sick leave. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Taller buildings, more homes near transit, demolition of old apartments and businesses. Those are three parts of a major rezoning plan for Seattle's University District. Mayor Murray announced it yesterday, and he called the rezoning a first-of-its-kind move. KUOW's growth and development reporter Joshua McNichols was there. Hello, Joshua.
Hey, Bill.
What makes a rezoning announcement such a huge deal?
Well, do you remember how we've been talking and reporting on asking developers to include affordable housing in their projects?
Oh, yes.
Well, it's going to happen in the U District first. And it's wise because of this rezoning. I mean, this requirement that we talked about in dense parts of the city is tied to, you know, letting developers build bigger. And because the U District has been thinking about rezoning the U District for a longer period of time, for 5 years, it's going to be ready first. So there are projects that are maybe being designed right now that haven't submitted for a permit yet, that by the time they submit, this law will be in effect. Early next year, even, if Councilmember Rob Johnson's right. So we could be seeing affordable housing pretty soon.
Why does the mayor want to focus on the University District?
Well, light rail is coming in 2021 to the Brooklyn Avenue station.
We've already got it south end of the campus there.
That's right. But in this area, there's a lot more housing. You know, there it's great for Husky Stadium and stuff.
Right.
But here, this end of the campus is where the housing is. And there's lots of parking lots here. So there's actually a lot of room compared to like Capitol Hill, where so much of the property around the light rail station is already built out. There's a lot more development potential here. Plus, it's a really promising neighborhood because the UW is right next door.
Yes, the UW, the giant employer. And what does the university say about the upzoning plan?
Well, they're generally happy about it. I mean, they've been at the table, and if it's done right, it could feed into the university's larger vision for the neighborhood. They want this neighborhood to become what they call an innovation district. That means it's the place where all that government investment that goes into the university interacts with the private sector. In other words, it's where the university takes its big ideas and turns them into money-making businesses that help run the economy. Developing innovation districts near universities is part of a national trend.
Ah, so is it the University of Washington that's driving this upzoning plan?
Well, there's other players at the table, too, like the people who own all the parking lots in the U District. They're an organized group, and they've got a lot of influence, and they want to make money by developing the property. But a lot of them are also small business owners who care about the neighborhood's long-term health. And then there are developers like Vulcan, who's developing some housing here. So stakeholders like that, they may have different interests than the UW, and they probably control more property in the U District than the UW does. The UW needs cheap housing for all the people who work here. It needs cheap office space so that the startups it's incubating in the U District have a place they can afford when they live the when they leave the nest. And if developers approach projects wanting to sort of squeeze the most money out of them, then the office space and the market rate apartments that get built could end up being more on the expensive end.
We're talking about our neighborhood, our work neighborhood. Joshua, KUOW is here on the Ave. And as you know, the U District has a lot of older buildings, a lot of older apartments that are relatively affordable compared to the rest of the city. What happens to that relatively affordable housing?
Well, some of it will be destroyed. I mean, the mayor says a lot of it was sort of doomed anyway, because development was coming. At least, he says, at least in exchange for letting developers build taller, we can squeeze developers a little and make them build some affordable units. But the places where I used to rent when I was a student here, you know, that was
me too.
Basically, you too.
Yeah,
basically
yeah.
A built out, attic space with a, you know, no legal escape window or anything like that. You know, Right. Those places, they may be gone.
Now, we've been talking about some of the hopes for this University District upzone. Not everybody at yesterday's announcement is happy. So what concerns do the skeptics have?
Well, one concern they have is that we're going to actually destroy more affordable housing than we're going to build. Another concern is that if we build up the neighborhood so it's so dense, it doesn't have the infrastructure to support all the people. I spoke to a guy named Corey Crocker who's been lobbying for a public square in the U District. And you might say, well, they have all that open space on the UW campus nearby, right? Well, Crocker says, wrong.
We have no space of our own. If the university were willing to cede Red Square to us, that might be a good idea, but it's not going to happen. So campus is only meant for a select group of people.
Crocker says you can't protest in Red Square unless you're part of a student group. And having public spaces where you can gather whenever you want, that's part of a healthy, well-balanced neighborhood.
As we've said, Joshua, the University District has struggled financially for a long time. We've seen plans come and go with mayors intending to remake this neighborhood. So what is your take on whether this plan will actually work?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, we did see one of our editors here was mentioning Greg Nickel's former mayor's plan to sort of remake the neighborhood. And they invested in sidewalks and street lamps. And, you know, but even after that, there were storefronts that remained vacant for years and years. Like the old Tower Records building was just a hole for so long.
Right.
But that's going to change now. We know that's going to change because of this one critical ingredient, the light rail station on Brooklyn Avenue. You know, there's so much development potential here, but I think you got to define success based on whether we preserve the economic diversity that's here now. There's tiny restaurants that can start up on a shoestring budget. There's, you know, bargain apartments. The Ave has always been this beautiful mixture of promise and seediness, and we'll see if that seediness gets preserved.
Should be fascinating. First neighborhood to go through it in a way, as we've been learning from KUOW's growth and development reporter, Joshua McNichols. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. In other news, the National Toy Hall of Fame is running out of nominees. The museum honors the great toys that have fostered learning or creativity through play. Monopoly is in the Toy Hall of Fame. Slinky's there. Hula Hoop. Today, the museum named 12 finalists for its class of 2016, and they include the swing, coloring books, and bubble wrap. Bubble wrap? Please explain, Board Member Chris Bench.
The cardboard box was the first non-manufactured or non-official toy that we inducted into the Hall of Fame. And since then, we've also inducted the stick and the blanket.
Good luck, bubble wrap. If the stick is in, certainly you deserve consideration. My kids have stepped on you. You've worked so hard for this. This is The Record. Right now, there are 8 schools in Washington State that are getting money in a way that's unconstitutional. They're called charter schools. And even though the Washington State Supreme Court made its ruling against charter schools last year, the schools are still open. Students are still attending. So what's going on? Here to tell us is KUOW's education reporter, Ann Dornfeld. And first, she reminds us exactly what a charter school is.
Charter schools are publicly funded but privately run schools. They exist within a larger K-12 system, but they exist independently of school districts. Each charter school is its own school district or a couple of charter schools could be their own school district, but they exist outside of traditional school districts.
And why would we want some of our public schools to be run privately and independently?
Some people like the idea of charter schools because they feel like their kids are not getting served within the traditional public school system. And they like the idea of a school that has more latitude potentially in what it teaches or how it teaches, but maybe longer school years, longer days, different ways of teaching kids, like more project-based learning, things that they just aren't seeing in their child's school right now.
Okay, that's the hope, except a year ago, the Washington State Supreme Court said that the way we were funding charter schools is unconstitutional. What effect has that had?
Well, the schools got to stay open all last year. Some of them were privately funded, but others were getting state funding still. There's kind of a creative solution that allowed a school district near Spokane to kind of adopt the schools in a system that is usually reserved for things like online learning. So the schools got to get public funding through that school. And then this legislature created a new charter school law that now funds charters through lottery dollars and made some other structural changes to how charters are run and overseen.
So here we are, charter schools still existing in Washington. They're open for the fall. And are students there experiencing anything different this year?
Well, the staff of the charters has worked really hard, I think, to try to maintain an even keel and make the school day as typical as possible from kids from the very beginning, because right as they were opening last year, the Supreme Court ruling came down, and that cost them some students. I think the main thing that they will see this year is actually a growing student body, because the schools plan to ramp up their enrollment by a grade each year. And so now some schools will be twice as big.
Since the Washington State Supreme Court ruling last year, there's now another lawsuit filed against the way that we keep charter schools open. What's happening with this attempt?
Well, this is mostly the same plaintiffs who filed the original successful lawsuit that have filed the new lawsuit. They say that the new law is still not constitutional. It still relies on public funding for privately run schools that have appointed rather than elected boards. They feel that's undemocratic. And they say that with regular K-12 schools still not amply funded in the state as required by the state constitution, that it is galling to fund a whole new set of schools. There's been a lot of back and forth in this lawsuit. There were motions filed by a group of charter schools, their association, as well as some parents of kids in charter schools. They were seeking to dismiss the organizations, for instance, that were supporting this lawsuit, the plaintiffs in this lawsuit. And then the plaintiffs filed a motion to dismiss the parents in the case. So a lot of back and forth between the two sides, and my email box is filling up.
That's a lot going on. What do you think the future of charter schools in Washington is, Anne?
I will be fascinated to find out. There are several charter schools that had actually planned to open this fall and have been in kind of a holding period. So they postponed their opening dates after the initial Supreme Court ruling came down. They were going to open this fall, now looks like next year, but they have been actively recruiting students. And it seems like a lot of parents and families still are feeling really optimistic about the future of charters. And as for the lawsuits, I think we just need to stay tuned.
And we will, to KUOW's education reporter Ann Dornfeld, following the charter school saga for you. Now, speaking of schools, former Husky student and University of Washington president Mark Emmert is now president of the NCAA, and that group has pulled 7 championship events and tournament games out of North Carolina because of a state law there that some people say can lead to discrimination against LGBT people. Emmert says he is working aggressively to find new locations for the events, the biggest one being the first round of the NCAA men's basketball tournament in March. And we are going to talk more about the NCAA's decision later this afternoon when you're joining us for KUOW's All Things Considered. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Every year, lung cancer kills more Americans than breast cancer, prostate, colorectal, and pancreatic cancer combined. Nearly 160,000 Americans will die of lung cancer this year. And yet, raising money for lung cancer research and awareness is really hard. Activists claim it's because people see lung cancer as a smoker's disease, even though thousands of men and women diagnosed with lung cancer have never touched a cigarette. Writer Janet Freeman Daly is one of those people. She was diagnosed with advanced lung cancer in 2011.
I'd had a nagging cough kind of a for a few months, and my husband finally said, you know, we'd you go to the doctor. So we tried a round of antibiotics, and it did nothing, and tried another round of antibiotics, and they said, let's do a chest x-ray. Oh, my God, look at that. I had a 6-centimeter tumor in my left lung.
And you didn't smoke, and it sounds like you didn't approve of people who did.
Well, at that point, I hadn't really thought about it as much. I grew up with a father who was a doctor and believed very strongly that smoking was bad for you. He didn't allow people to smoke in our home. He made sure his children knew that they shouldn't smoke. And so I had kind of a built-in belief that smoking was bad for you and people who smoked were deliberately doing something that was bad for them. My mind has changed quite a bit.
You mentioned that your husband said, would you go to a doctor? You'd been coughing. I would imagine that the fact that you didn't smoke delayed your finding out what was going on with you because that wasn't the furthest thing from your mind.
That's true. And the number of people who are never smokers who get lung cancer is increasing. So there's something besides tobacco that is causing lung cancer for many people. I know a number of young people in their 20s and 30s that are getting diagnosed with lung cancer. Some of them exercise every day, eat healthy. I even know a vegan that just out of the blue got this lung cancer. They can't say where it came from, but they did everything right and they still got it. A lot of these young people, because the doctors don't suspect that lung cancer is a possibility, will find that the doctors say it's asthma. Oh, okay, well, you've got an allergy. Oh, you've got pneumonia. So they don't get a full workup for, like, in some cases, a year. And by then, the disease is metastatic.
And for those who don't know, what is metastatic?
Lung cancer is staged by where it is in the body. When it stays within the lungs, it's stage one. And the most advanced stage, metastatic, means that it's gotten outside the lungs into other organs in the body. And that generally means that the disease is very aggressive and it's harder to treat. Half of patients with lung cancer are diagnosed metastatic, and half of us will be dead within the first year. But worldwide, 25% of people diagnosed with lung cancer never smoked. That doesn't mean that I think that people who smoked deserve it or did it to themselves. No one deserves this disease. It's healthier not to smoke, but that's not a sin that requires the death penalty.
Why does it matter that many of us assume lung cancer comes from smoking?
Because a lot of people, through the ads against cigarettes, which always say, you know, cigarettes cause lung cancer up until the past few years, the public has equated the idea of smoking with lung cancer. And the extension of that is you did it to yourself. You know, you chose this disease. There's a concomitant reduction in funding for lung cancer research. The government spend less on lung cancer, if you measure it per death, than the average person spends on their air travel each year in the U.S. We get less funding than the other major cancers, even though lung cancer causes more deaths than the other top three cancers combined. But there's also a problem with patients not getting support because people think you did it to yourself. When I tell people I have lung cancer, one of the first questions I get asked is, did you smoke? And there's also, it even extends to the doctors.
And this is not just your opinion. There's a documented effect of a stigma around lung cancer.
Yes. The Lung Cancer Project conducted a survey of the general public, of patients, of healthcare providers, to ask them their opinions, and they were looking at how they felt about lung cancer. And they found that patients, healthcare professionals, caregivers, and the general public were all equally biased against lung cancer. They tended to see it as something that they did to themselves. There was also a study in the Journal of Thoracic Oncology that showed that primary care physicians were less likely to refer people with advanced lung cancer to treatment than they were for people with advanced breast cancer. I've heard patients report that when they originally go in to get diagnosed with lung cancer and the doctor has a certain kind of dismissive attitude and then he finds out they're never smokers and it's like, oh, okay, you know, and the whole attitude changes. It shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't matter whether or not we smoked. I mean, heck, I got through grad school eating bags of M&Ms. Sugar is really bad for you and associated with a lot of diseases. But if I were to go in and get diabetes, the doctor doesn't say, oh, you had sugar in grad school.
Yeah, some listeners might think that there's some kind of competition or resentment between smokers and non-smokers when it comes to lung cancer, but I don't hear that from you. I hear you empathizing with smokers more than you ever had.
Oh, absolutely. Most people, 90% of people start smoking before age 18. When we're all young and are going to live forever and make all sorts of choices, healthy or otherwise. The difference between choosing to smoke and other choices is that smoking is terribly addictive. It is more addictive than heroin or cocaine, much harder to quit. And the cigarette industry over time has put additives in their cigarettes to make them more addictive. I wrote a blog post at one point saying, "Dear lung cancer patient who smoked," written from the viewpoint of someone who never smoked, expressing my sympathy and recognizing how tough it is to kick cigarettes. And a friend of mine who has lung cancer who did smoke wrote a very good response, "Dear lung cancer patient who didn't smoke," and explained that when she was 14, her older sister, who was 2 years older, started smoking. And she wanted to do everything her sister did. So she started smoking and then realized how hard it was to quit. So when she was 35, she made the effort and she quit. And she got all sorts of congratulatory letters. "Good for you." Every year on her quit anniversary, she'd get letters saying, "Keep up the good work." And in her 40s, she got diagnosed with lung cancer. And the response was, "Oh, well, you smoked." So even when she started when she was a, forgive me, dumb kid and did something that she now regrets, and she did what she was supposed to, she quit and had a more healthy lifestyle, she still gets blamed for the stigma. That's not right. No one deserves lung cancer. Anyone can get lung cancer. All you need is lungs.
Janet, what are the doctors telling you, and what are you thinking about your prognosis and your future?
I have had no evidence of disease since January of 2013. Knock on wood. The treatments for lung cancer are evolving very fast. We have had more new drugs for lung cancer in the past 4 years than in the previous 4 decades. There's a lot of hope, but it's moving so fast that most doctors aren't aware of it. A general oncologist has too many cancers to keep track of. They can't know everything that's happening in lung cancer. You need a lung cancer specialist. And if you have metastatic lung cancer, you need to go get a second opinion at an academic cancer center. You can go to nccn.org, which is the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, and get a list of their facilities and see if you can get a second opinion at one of those places. If you can't travel there, at least one of them, the University of Colorado, will provide a remote second opinion. You can send them your information and get it. It's not covered by insurance, but it's well worth it.
Janet Freeman Daly is a writer and an advocate for lung cancer patients. We're tweeting out a link to the Lung Cancer Awareness Walk that she's participating in this Saturday, the Puget Sound Free to Breathe Walk. And there you'll also find information about how you can get involved in lung cancer awareness and research. You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Universities are starting fall term this month, and most of the professors will not be full-time. Nationwide, more than half of professors are adjuncts, part-time workers who are paid on a per-class basis and get few or no benefits, while tenured faculty are practically employed for life. At Seattle University, Nancy Burkhalter has been an adjunct professor for 4 years. She told me adjuncts often cannot be on campus when the students are, and that those out-of-class interactions matter.
I love students, and I love seeing them on campus. I love finding out how they're doing. I like encouraging them and seeing how their classes are going after they leave mine. I mean, it's a community, and I feel very much ripped out of that community, and I don't think they understand it so much, what the hierarchy is at a university. They don't understand why I'm not there. Why am I not a full-time employee? What does that mean? But also then parents are affected by this because I'm sure that for the money that they spend, they expect people, teachers, to be up to the minute on everything. They expect them to be of the highest quality, teacher-wise and research-wise and everything in their field. But if somebody's running off to get another job, sometimes at two other institutions, they don't always have enough time to do the research that they need to do to stay on top of things. So I think that a lot of people get cheated in this kind of situation.
What do you think adjuncts should have that they don't currently have?
Job security would be great. Health insurance would be terrific. Some kind of support from the department so we can go to conferences and not just go, but then also present, because when you go to conferences, you don't usually get reimbursed. So that's an important thing to keep up with what's going on in your field and maintain contacts and do networking and things like that. So that would be great, feeling as if you have a voice in the curriculum, in the book selection, the school, the class rosters shoved at you, and then you have books given to you, and that's what you teach. Doesn't matter whether it fits your own teaching style or your own level of expertise.
How do you make the case to a university that job security, better benefits, off-class hours, your input into the curriculum, how do you make the case that all of this will benefit that student?
I think that students really benefit when there is continuity, that they can go to a department and they see that the faculty are there on a regular basis, that there is continuity not just in what is taught, but then when there are sequences of courses, that they are adequately prepared to go into the next one. If you hire just one person to teach one course and then another person teaches the other course that's a sequence to that, there's no coordination there. And I think that is disruptive to the student.
Do you feel you're being exploited in a way that academia seems to be okay with?
Yes. Yeah, of course I do, because I've done everything everybody else has done to be what I am on the university, to stand in front of a student body or a class and teach them to the best of my ability. But I'm not getting any support to maintain that expertise. It's all on me to do that. And I necessarily need to do it because I need to make sure that I'm ready in case there's a full-time position that comes along that I can apply for. Yeah, it's definitely exploitative.
Maybe everyone doesn't know how much support a full-time faculty gets in the university family, community, compared to you.
I'm sure they don't.
What kind of support do you see your colleagues getting that you don't?
Well, they get summers off. They get a salary. They get to know that they're returning in the fall, that they actually have a job. I don't know that. I have 6 months when I don't have anything, unless I rustle up something at another university or what I've been doing, which is editing or some side work that I've done. And I think we just kind of take it the way that it comes at us because that's what the system is. I mean, adjuncts wouldn't exist if there were another model of a university and a situation. I don't know what that is. I'd have to think about how to go about that. But it's definitely taking advantage of an employment pool that is alienated. That's the best word I can think of.
What is that alienated experience like for you?
It means I don't have any real colleagues at the university. I'm not included in a lot of the activities. I just seem to be an afterthought.
It sounds like teaching at the college level is a tough field right now. Why don't you go into the private sector or teach at a different high school level?
Well, first of all, high school means that you have to have certain certification. So I'd have to go back to school to do that. Okay, that's one thing. But by telling me to do that, as other people have suggested, it somehow means that the premise is that the university system is okay the way that it is. And just for me to leave it doesn't solve the problem. Of course, there's somebody right behind me to take my place.
How should we run our universities then?
Well, you know, it's easy for me to sit here and say we should do this or do that, but tenured faculty, tenure-track faculty, and I mean, I understand what that system is, and I value it quite a bit. I value the free speech that it brings. But to do that at the expense of people who are doing the exact same job they are, it seems unfair.
At what point do you think it would be time for you to walk away from being an adjunct professor at Seattle U or anywhere?
If I get a full-time job, of course. I'm not sure. I haven't figured that out yet. I enjoy teaching so much that obviously it's been worth it for me to do this kind of thing. And I've done it at other universities, and I've had full-time jobs at other universities. But once I get in my classroom with my students, it's just me and them. And that's where the magic is for me. So all this other stuff that comes along with it is, yes, it's an irritant. And yes, I wish things were otherwise. But what is more magical than being a part of somebody's learning experience? I think next to parenting, teaching has got to be one of the most influential, groundbreaking things that you can do in a person's life. So that's why I teach. I'd like to do it full time, but this is what I have right now.
Nancy Burkhalter is an adjunct professor at Seattle University in the English Language and Culture Bridge program, and she wrote about her experience as an adjunct professor in Crosscut. We're tweeting out the link to her article now. By the way, last week, Seattle University adjuncts voted to unionize. There's a long process that comes now, but the union is expected to be certified sometime next week. And speaking of school starting up, do you know what is the most frequently diagnosed mental disorder in children? It is anxiety. And this afternoon, we're going to take you to a unique school that helps students with severe anxiety who have trouble going to class. That's coming up this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. The Record here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. 7 years ago, Seattle TV writer Melanie McFarland fell into a serious depression.
I don't know if you ever saw Men in Black. And if you haven't, sorry, spoiler alert. There's one character in there who is walking around and he looks like a human being, but they discover that it's actually this tiny, tiny, tiny little alien piloting the meat suit. And that's kind of what depression felt like to me, just completely my body and my brain disconnected.
During the time McFarland felt like that, hardly anything broke through to the person inside the meat suit. But this did.
This is your last chance to impress me and save yourself from elimination. The time has come for you to lip sync for your life.
That's a clip from the reality TV show RuPaul's Drag Race. The show just won RuPaul an Emmy for Best Reality Show Host. Drag Race pits drag queen contestants against each other in fashion and lip-syncing challenges.
It's like if America's Next Top Model and Project Runway had a baby and it was all drag queens.
Melanie McFarland told KUOW's Jeannie Yandel that RuPaul's Drag Race showed up at the perfect time, when McFarland was pushing herself through another day at work.
Part of my job actually was sorting through video at work. And one of the videos I saw was for RuPaul's Drag Race season 1, and it was coming through the feed. And so there were all these videos that we had to feature, but that one wasn't one of them. And so I would just watch these. I'd had two computer screens. I had the big one where I did my work, and then I had the other one where I had Drag Race up. And I was in a corner, so no one could see what I was watching. And I just remember there were a couple of times when RuPaul would say things about, even for the lip sync for your life, which, again, is part of the competition, the bottom two get to fight for the right to stay in by lip syncing to a particular song. And there was one that I remember in particular where RuPaul said, this song in particular is very special to me. It helped me during the toughest times in my life. And it's Martha Wash's Carry On.
I stand alone in the eye of the storm. Crashes all around, trying to wear me down. But I hold tight to what I know is right. Still can hear the way Mama used to say.
Why did that resonate with you so deeply?
Well, first of all, if you listen to the lyrics, it's all about no matter what, in spite of whatever adversity, you carry on, you keep going. And so it was this very emotional lip sync for your life, which is very strange because this is a competition reality show. It's supposed to be the lightest, most, you know, ephemeral thing you could possibly watch. It shouldn't affect anything about, you should be able to really, like, you know, do mathematic equations and like split atoms while reality show is in on the background. It requires nothing. And yet here was this moment where this is a host who tied the emotional to this very basic reality competition act. And it was gorgeous. It was just a brilliant moment. But then from there, I also just kind of looked, and there were other elements in my life too, where I became very aware of the need to make the outside of my body look different than the inside felt.
You talked about it in a piece you wrote about this.
Yes. As
you called it a sparkly facade, I believe.
Yeah, it was drag. I mean, that's one of the things he says. You're born naked and the rest is drag. But and it also went back to, like, there's this old Saturday Night Live character named Fernando from Fernando's Hideaway. And he'd say, darling, it's better to look good than to feel good. And the funny thing is, I think back on these, you know, the makeup I was putting on, and I'm sure it was in its own way just off, because again, I was still the alien in the meat suit. But it made me feel better, and it gave me more confidence, and it made me treat myself better.
Hmm. How did you know that that facade was actually helping you out in the world?
Because I could be out in the world for longer. And there's a sensation of depression. It's not just emptiness. I think for different people, it manifests differently. But for me, I really felt like there was a black hole in the middle of my body, like right where my stomach should be. Like I was just kind of sucking in the universe. And I felt that less and less. And I won't say that it's all Drag Race. It's not like that was my, you know, like TV Paxil. It wasn't. I mean, there were a lot of other things I did. But that was the one thing where I just said, okay, I'm going to look different than I feel. And that was a step.
At what point did looking different than you feel, when did that start reflecting the way you felt inside?
Yeah, I can't point to a specific time. I just felt more whole. I felt like I wasn't acting anymore. And part of it was just taking these things that I was imitating and just realizing that they were integrated into me. I didn't have to pretend to be the drag persona. You know, it's just like, I don't have to pretend to be fabulous. I am fabulous.
You said that Drag Race was not like your TV Paxil. It didn't fix everything. There
right.
were lots of other things that you did. Mm-hmm. But why do you think that that TV show was the thing that was able to help you, even in a small way?
I think it was several things. Number one, it was, as I said, it was the sparkle of it all. And watching people transform and be creative. And some of it was hearing the stories. Each of those contestants has a story coming there that is a story of endurance and heartbreak and overcoming. And, you know, I could see different elements of myself in a lot of these contestants. There's something to be said for a reality show that represents different parts of, like, almost the shadow self. And I think that's kind of what Drag Race does. There's the sunshine, but then there's like the shadow, but it's almost like putting rhinestones on the shadow and something else completely different coming out of it and beautiful.
How was your life different from when you first discovered that show and started watching it?
It's different in I made boundaries much more a priority. And part of that, I think, comes from watching. Look, if you watch enough drag queens, the way they carry themselves, you don't want to step too close to them unless you're invited. And it's not to say that they're like, oh, unapproachable and evil, but there's a certain way, what it's almost like they're channeling some sort of divine presence that you don't necessarily, like that we're drawn to, but at the same time want to keep a respectable distance. And I think that if I integrated anything from Drag Race into myself, it would be that. I don't want to be unapproachable, but I have put up boundaries just to take care of myself. And I think that's led to a healthier life. It's led to a life of me being able to say no and move forward into a place where I can choose, make choices out of joy and satisfaction. And I feel like I have a life that's more of a life of exploration now than I did. But part of that is just, you know, getting out of that depression valley. If I hadn't found Drag Race, I might be saying the same thing for different reasons. But I do think it was helpful in that regard. And, you know, it makes me basically kind of walk through life a little taller, which is something that I can't say that I did before. And I wish I'd gotten more of that kind of Drag Race magic in my life earlier. Things would have been different, I think.
That's Seattle writer Melanie McFarland. 7 years ago, the reality TV show RuPaul's Drag Race helped her climb out of her depression. This weekend, RuPaul won his first Emmy for Best Reality Show Host. We are tweeting out a link to the piece that Melanie wrote about Drag Race and depression now. So follow us at KUOW. On the subject of TV shows, I've never seen the Great British Baking Show. I know people who love it. I know it's a hit. There's apparently some controversy over the show that includes the hosts leaving, and we will tell you the whole crusty, aromatic story later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. And finally, this hour, something else you might have seen on television. On Sunday, the Seattle Seahawks players and coaches linked arms and stood during the national anthem. They called it a display of unity. It was also a careful response to the trend of NFL players sitting or kneeling during the anthem to protest police violence toward black men. So yesterday, I talked with a writer, Dr. Jason Johnson of The Root, who is a Seahawks fan, but not a fan of this choice.
If someone wants to take a stand against police brutality, if someone wants to stand in solidarity with Colin Kaepernick, that's fine. And if a team or individuals on that team decide that they want to put their hands on their heart for the pledge or something else like that, then that is fine. But you don't want to take the mushy middle where you basically don't make any statement. And that, unfortunately, is what the Seattle Seahawks did yesterday. They neither stood against police brutality, nor did they stand in support of anything that was important. They did something in the mushy middle, and in the end, it was both confusing and really a diminishment of the key issues that started this kind of protest.
Now, we heard from several of you in response, several who were not fans of Johnson's argument. Chelsea from Seattle said, too harsh.
Particularly in the context of the fact that it was September 11th, and if there's a time when we need to stand and show unity as a country, it is September 11th. And these conversations, this disruption that he's hoping for, can wait for another Sunday.
John from Seattle said he agreed with the tone the Seahawks hit with their linked arms demonstration.
They did a solidarity thing. They didn't go overboard with it. And personally, I think they should keep the politics out of football and bring it up somewhere else. It's for watching football, not politics.
However, other listeners were much more enthusiastic. Maureen is a fan, a 12, she says, and she thinks the Seahawks should be congratulated.
I think that they created a platform to have a discussion without completely putting down things that they disagree with. And, you know, I don't think that they all probably agree on everything among each other 100%, but I think that they did a great job, and hopefully we can all make it a safer country for everybody, because it is unsafe to be a black man in particular to be of color. I just realized the curse, and sorry about that, or I said an inappropriate thing. But it is unsafe to be a person of color in this country, and being white is a privilege in this country, and hopefully the stance that the Seahawks took can lead to a better discussion of this, such as white Pacific Northwesterners apologizing for using the C word the wrong way. So, yeah, good for the Hawks.
Thank you, Maureen. We always like to hear from you. Thank you for your tweets, your emails, your phone calls. Let us know what you think about any story. What do you want us to cover here? Our email address is record@kuow.org. And you can give us a call, just like Maureen and those others did there, 206-221-3663. Again, that's 221-3663. And I hope you will download the podcast of this program. You can get it wherever you get your favorite podcast app, iTunes, etc. Thanks for listening.